out companies reformed. Now steadily they came marching back. They reached the gate of the city and entered, stepping proudly. And proudly the people of the city looked on them, and cried their praise, and yet they were troubled in heart, for the companies were grievously reduced. Faramir had lost a third of his men, and where was he? Last of all he came. His men passed in, the mounted knights returned, and at their rear the banner of Dol Amroth and the prince. And in his arms before him on his horse he bore the body of his kinsman, Faramir, son of Denethor, found upon the stricken field. "Faramir! Faramir!" men cried, weeping in the streets. But he did not answer, and they bore him away up the winding road to the citadel and his father. Even as the Nazgul had swerved aside from the onset of the White Rider, there came flying a deadly dart, and Faramir, as he held at bay a mounted champion of Harad, had fallen to the earth. Only the charge of Dol Amroth had saved him from the red Southland swords that would have hewed him as he lay. The Prince Imrahil brought Faramir to the White Tower, and he said, "Your son has returned, Lord, after great deeds," and he told all that he had seen. But Denethor rose and looked on the face of his son and was silent. Then he bade them make a bed in the chamber and lay Faramir upon it and depart. But he himself went up alone into the secret room under the summit of the tower, and many who looked up thither at that time saw a pale light that gleamed and flickered from the narrow windows for a while, and then flashed and went out. And when Denethor descended again, he went to Faramir and sat beside him without speaking, but the face of the Lord was grey, more death-like than his son's. So now at last the city was besieged, enclosed in a ring of foes. The Ramas was broken, and all the Pelennor abandoned to the enemy. The last word to come from outside the walls was brought by men flying down the northward road ere the gate was shut. They were the remnant of the guard that was kept at that point where the way from Anorion and Rohan ran into the townlands. Ingold led them, the same who had admitted Gandalf and Pippin less than 5 days before, while the sun still rose and there was hope in the morning. "There is no news of the Rohirrim," he said. "Rohan will not come now, or if they come, it will not avail us. The new host that we had tidings of has come first, from over the river by way of Andros, it is said. They're strong, battalions of Orcs of the Eye, and countless companies of men of a new sort that we have not met before. Not tall, but broad and grim, bearded like dwarves, wielding great axes. Out of some savage land in the wide east they come, we deem. They hold the northward road, and many have passed on into Anorion. The Rohirrim cannot come." The gate was shut. All night watchmen on the walls heard the rumour of the enemy that roamed outside, burning field and tree, and hewing any man that they found abroad, living or dead. The numbers that had already passed over the river could not be guessed in the darkness, but when morning, or its dim shadow, stole over the plain, it was seen that even fear by night had scarcely overcounted them. The plain was dark with their marching companies, and as far as eyes could strain in the murk there sprouted, like a foul fungus growth, all about the beleaguered city great camps of tents, black or sombre red. Busy as ants, hurrying orcs were digging lines of deep trenches in a huge ring, just out of bowshot from the walls, and as the trenches were made each was filled with fire, though how it was kindled or fed, by art or devilry, none could see. All day the labour went forward, while the men of Minas Tirith looked on, unable to hinder it. And as each length of trench was completed, they could see great wains approaching, and soon yet more companies of the enemy were swiftly setting up, each behind the cover of a trench, great engines for the casting of missiles. There were none upon the city walls large enough to reach so far or to stay the work. At first men laughed and did not greatly fear such devices, for the main wall of the city was of great height and marvellous thickness, built ere the power and craft of Numenor waned in exile. and its outward face was like to the tower of Orthonk, hard and dark and smooth, unconquerable by steel or fire, unbreakable except by some convulsion that would rend the very earth on which it stood. "Nay," they said, "not if the Nameless One himself should come. Not even he could enter here while we yet live." But some answered, "While we yet live? How long? He has a weapon that has brought low many strong places since the world began. Hunger. The roads are cut. Rohan will not come." But the engines did not waste shot upon the indomitable wall. It was no brigand or orc chieftain that ordered the assault upon the Lord of Mordor's greatest foe. A power and mind of malice guided it. As soon as the great catapults were set, with many yells and the creaking of rope and winch, they began to throw missiles marvellously high, so that they passed right above the battlement and fell thudding within the first circle of the city, and many of them, by some secret art, burst into flame as they came toppling down. Soon there was great peril of fire behind the wall, and all who could be spared were busy quelling the flames that sprang up in many places. Then among the greater castes there fell another hail, less ruinous but more horrible. All about the streets and lanes behind the gate it tumbled down, small round shot that did not burn. But when men ran to learn what it might be, they cried aloud or wept, for the enemy was flinging into the city all the heads of those who had fallen fighting at Osgiliath, or on the Ramas, or in the field. They were grim to look on, for though some were crushed and shapeless, and some had been cruelly hewn, yet many had features that could be told, and it seemed that they had died in pain, and all were branded with a foul token of the lidless eye. But marred and dishonoured as they were, it often chanced that thus a man would see again the face of someone that he had known, who had walked proudly once in arms, or tilled the fields, or ridden in upon a holiday from the green vales in the hills. In vain men shook their fists at the pitiless foes that swarmed before the gate. Curses they heeded not, nor understood the tongues of western men, crying with harsh voices like beasts and carrion birds. But soon there were few left in Minas Tirith who had the heart to stand up and defy the hosts of Mordor. For yet another weapon, swifter than hunger, the Lord of the Dark Tower had, dread and despair. The Nazgûl came again, and as their dark lord now grew and put forth his strength, so their voices, which uttered only his will and his malice, were filled with evil and horror. Ever they circled above the city, like vultures that expect their fill of doomed men's flesh. Out of sight and shot they flew, and yet were ever present, and their deadly voices rent the air. More unbearable they became, not less, at each new cry. At length even the stout-hearted would fling themselves to the ground as the hidden menace passed over them, or they would stand, letting their weapons fall from nerveless hands, while into their minds a blackness came, and they thought no more of war, but only of hiding and of crawling, and of death. During all this black day, Faramir lay upon his bed in the chamber of the White Tower, wandering in a desperate fever. Dying, someone said, and soon dying, all men were saying upon the walls and in the streets. And by him his father sat, and said nothing, but watched, and gave no longer any heed to the defence. No hours so dark had Pippin known, not even the clutches of the Uruk-hai. It was his duty to wait upon the Lord, and wait he did, forgotten, it seemed, standing by the door of the unlit chamber, mastering his own fears as best he could. And as he watched, it seemed to him that Denethor grew old before his eyes, as if something had snapped in his proud will, and his stern mind was overthrown. Grief, maybe, had wrought it, and remorse. He saw tears on that once tearless face, more unbearable than wrath. "Do not weep, Lord," he stammered. "Perhaps he will get well. Have you asked Gandalf?"
"Comfort me not with wizards," said Denethor. "The fool's hope has failed. The enemy has found it, and now his power waxes. He sees our very thoughts, and all we do is ruinous. I sent my son forth, unthanked, unblessed, out into needless peril, and here he lies with poison in his veins. Nay, nay, whatever may now betide in war, my line too is ending. Even the house of the stewards has failed. Mean folk shall rule the last remnant of the kings of men, lurking in the hills until all are hounded out.
Men came to the door, crying for the lord of the city.
Nay, I will not come down, he said. I must stay beside my son. He might still speak before the end, but that is near. Follow whom you will, even the grey fool, though his hope has failed. Here I stay.
So it was that Gandalf took command of the last defence of the city of Gondor. Wherever he came, men's hearts would lift again, and the winged shadows pass from memory. Tirelessly he strode from citadel to gate, from north to south about the wall, and with him went the Prince of Dol Amroth in his shining mail. For he and his knights still held themselves like lords in whom the race of Numenor ran true. Men that saw them whispered, saying, "Belike the old tales speak well. There is elvish blood in the veins of that folk, for the people of Nimrodel dwelt in that land once long ago." And then one would sing amid the gloom some staves of the Lay of Nimrodel, or other songs of the Vale of Anduin out of vanished years. And yet, when they had gone, the shadows closed on men again, and their hearts went cold, and the valour of Gondor withered into ash. And so slowly they passed out of a dim day of fears into the darkness of a desperate night. Fires now raged unchecked in the first circle of the city, and the garrison upon the outer wall was already in many places cut off from retreat. But the faithful who remained there at their posts were few. Most had fled beyond the second gate. Far behind the battle, the river had been swiftly bridged, and all day more force and gear of war had poured across. Now at last, in the middle night, the assault was loosed. The vanguard passed through the trenches of fire by many devious paths that had been left between them. On they came, reckless of their loss as they approached, still bunched and herded, within the range of bowmen on the wall. But indeed there were too few now left there to do them great damage. Though the light of the fires showed up many a mark for archers of such skill as Gondor once had boasted. Then, perceiving that the valour of the city was already beaten down, the hidden captain put forth his strength. Slowly the great siege towers built in Osgiliath rolled forward through the dark. Messengers came again to the chamber in the White Tower, and Pippin let them enter, for they were urgent. Denethor turned his head slowly from Faramir's face and looked at them silently. "The first circle of the city is burning, lord," they said. "What are your commands? You are still the lord and steward. Not all will follow Mithrandir. Men are flying from the walls and leaving them unmanned."
"Why? Why do the fools fly?" said Denethor. "Better to burn sooner than late, for burn we must. Go back to your bonfire, and I will go now to my pyre. To my pyre. No tomb for Denethor and Faramir. No tomb. No long slow sleep of death embalmed. We will burn like heathen kings before ever a ship sailed hither from the west. The west has failed. Go back and burn."
The messengers, without bow or answer, turned and fled. Now Denethor stood up and released the fevered hand of Faramir that he had held.
"He is burning, already burning," he said sadly. "The house of his spirit crumbles."
Then, stepping softly towards Pippin, he looked down at him.
"Farewell," he said. "Farewell, Peregrine, son of Paladin. Your service has been short, and now it is drawing to an end. I release you from the little that remains. Go now, and die in what way seems best to you. And with whom you will, even that friend whose folly brought you to this death. Send for my servants, and then go. Farewell."
"I will not say farewell, my lord," said Pippin, kneeling.
And then suddenly, hobbit-like once more, he stood up and looked the old man in the eyes. "I will take your leave, sir," he said, "for I want to see Gandalf very much indeed. But he's no fool, and I will not think of dying until he despairs of life. But from my word and your service I do not wish to be released while you live, and if they come at last to the citadel, I hope to be here and stand before you and earn, perhaps, the alms that you have given me."
"Do as you will, Master Halfling," said Denethor, "but my life is broken. Send for my servants." He turned back to Faramir.
Pippin left him and called for the servants, and they came. 6 men of the household, strong and fair, yet they trembled at the summons. But in a quiet voice Denethor bade them lay warm coverlets on Faramir's bed and take it up. And they did so, and lifting up the bed, they bore it from the chamber. Slowly they paced to trouble the fevered man as little as might be, and Denethor, now bending on a staff, followed them. And last came Pippin. Out from the white tower they walked, as if to a funeral, out into the darkness, where the overhanging cloud was lit beneath with flickers of dull red. Softly they paced the great courtyard, and at a word from Denethor halted beside the withered tree. All was silent, save for the rumour of war in the city down below, and they heard the water dripping sadly from the dead branches into the dark pool. Then they went on through the citadel gate, where the sentinels stared at them in wonder and dismay as they passed by. Turning westward, they came at length to a door in the rearward wall of the 6th circle. Fen Holland it was called, for it was kept ever shut, save at times of funeral, and only the lord of the city might use that way, or those who bore the token of the tombs and tended the houses of the dead. Beyond it went a winding road, that descended in many curves down to the narrow land, under the shadow of Mindoluin's precipice, where stood the mansions of the dead kings and of their stewards. A porter sat in a little house beside the way, and with fear in his eyes he came forth bearing a lantern in his hand. At the lord's command he unlocked the door, and silently it swung back, and they passed through, taking the lanterns from his hand. It was dark on the climbing road, between ancient walls and many-pillared balusters looming in the swaying lantern beams. Their slow feet echoed as they walked down, down, until at last they came to the silent street, Rath Dinan, between pale domes and empty halls and images of men long dead, and they entered into the house of the stewards and set down their burden. There Pippin, staring uneasily about him, saw that he was in a wide vaulted chamber, draped, as it were, with the great shadows that the little lantern threw upon its shrouded walls, and dimly to be seen were many rows of tables, carved of marble, and upon each table lay a sleeping form, hands folded, head pillowed upon stone. But one table near at hand stood broad and bare. Upon it, at a sign from Denethor, they laid Faramir and his father side by side, and covered them with one covering, and stood then with bowed heads, as mourners beside a bed of death. Then Denethor spoke in a low voice.
"Here we will wait," he said, "but send not for the embalmers. Bring us wood quick to burn, and lay it all about us, and beneath, and pour oil upon it, and when I bid you thrust in a torch, do this and speak no more to me. Farewell."
"By your leave, lord," said Pippin, and turned and fled in terror from the deathly house. "Poor Faramir," he thought. "I must find Gandalf. Poor Faramir. Quite likely he needs medicine more than tears. Oh, where can I find Gandalf? In the thick of things, I suppose, and he will have no time to spare for dying men or madmen." At the door he turned to one of the servants who had remained on guard there. "Your master is not himself," he said. "Go slow. Bring no fire to this place while Faramir lives. Do nothing until Gandalf comes."
"Who is the master of Minas Tirith?" the man answered. "The Lord Denethor or the Grey Wanderer?"
"The Grey Wanderer or no one, it would seem," said Pippin. and he sped back and up the winding way as swiftly as his feet would carry him, past the astonished porter, out through the door, and on, till he came near the gate of the citadel. The sentinel hailed him as he went by, and he recognized the voice of Beregond. "Whither do you run, Master Peregrine?" he cried. "To find Mithrandir," Pippin answered.
"The Lord's errands are urgent, and should not be hindered by me," said Beregond. "But tell me quickly, if you may, what goes forward? Whither has my lord gone? I've just come on duty, but I heard that he passed towards the closed door, and men were bearing Faramir before him."
"Yes," said Pippin, "to the silent street." Beregond bowed his head to hide his tears.
"They said that he was dying," he sighed, "and now he is dead."
"No," said Pippin, "not yet. And even now his death might be prevented, I think. But the lord of the city, Beregond, has fallen before his city is taken. He is fey and dangerous." Quickly he told of Denethor's strange words and deeds. "I must find Gandalf at once."
"Then you must go down to the battle."
"I know. The lord has given me leave. But, Beregond, if you can, do something to stop any dreadful thing happening."
"The lord does not permit those who wear the black and silver to leave their post for any cause, save at his own command."
"Well, you must choose between orders and the life of Faramir," said Pippin. "And as for orders, I think you have a madman to deal with, not a lord. I must run. I will return if I can." He ran on, down, down towards the outer city. Men flying back from the burning passed him, and some, seeing his livery, turned and shouted, but he paid no heed. At last he was through the second gate, beyond which great fires leapt up between the walls, yet it seemed strangely silent. No noise or shouts of battle or din of arms could be heard. Then suddenly there was a dreadful cry and a great shock, and a deep echoing boom. Forcing himself on against a gust of fear and horror that shook him almost to his knees, Pippin turned a corner, opening on the wide place behind the city gate. He stopped dead. He had found Gandalf, but he shrank back, cowering into a shadow. Ever since the middle night the great assault had gone on. The drums rolled. To the north and to the south, company upon company of the enemy pressed to the walls. There came great beasts, like moving houses in the red and fitful light. The Mumakil of the Harad, dragging through the lanes amid the fires, huge towers and engines. Yet their captain cared not greatly what they did or how many might be slain. Their purpose was only to test the strength of the defence, and to keep the men of Gondor busy in many places. It was against the gate that he would throw his heaviest weight. Very strong it might be, wrought of steel and iron, and guarded with towers and bastions of indomitable stone, yet it was the key, the weakest point in all that high and impenetrable wall. The drums rolled louder. Fires leapt up. Great engines crawled across the field, and in the midst was a huge ram, great as a forest tree 100 feet in length, swinging on mighty chains. Long had it been forging in the dark smithies of Mordor, and its hideous head, founded of black steel, was shaped in the likeness of a ravening wolf. On its spells of ruin lay. Grond they named it, in memory of the hammer of the underworld of old. Great beasts drew it, orcs surrounded it, and behind walked mountain trolls to wield it. But about the gate resistance still was stout, and there the knights of Dol Amroth and the hardiest of the garrison stood at bay. Shot and dart fell thick. Siege towers crashed or blazed suddenly like torches. All before the walls on either side of the gate, the ground was choked with wreck and with bodies of the slain, yet still driven, as by a madness, more and more came up. Grond crawled on. Upon its housing no fire would catch, and though now and again some great beast that hauled it would go mad and spread stamping ruin among the orcs innumerable that guarded it, their bodies were cast aside from its path, and others took their place. Grond crawled on. The drums rolled wildly. Over the hills of slain a hideous shape appeared, a horseman, tall, hooded, cloaked in black. Slowly, trampling the fallen, he rode forth, heeding no longer any dart. He halted and held up a long, pale sword, and as he did so, a great fear fell on all, defender and foe alike, and the hands of men drooped to their sides, and no bow sang. For a moment all was still. The drums rolled and rattled. With a vast rush, Grond was hurled forward by huge hands. It reached the gate. It swung. A deep boom rumbled through the city, like thunder running in the clouds. But the doors of iron and posts of steel withstood the stroke. Then the black captain rose in his stirrups and cried aloud in a dreadful voice, speaking in some forgotten tongue words of power and terror to rend both heart and stone. Thrice he cried. Thrice the great ram boomed, and suddenly upon the last stroke the gate of Gondor broke. As if stricken by some blasting spell, it burst asunder. There was a flash of searing lightning, and the doors tumbled in ribbon fragments to the ground. In rode the Lord of the Nazgûl. A great black shape against the fires beyond he loomed up, grown to a vast menace of despair. In rode the Lord of the Nazgûl, under the archway that no enemy ever yet had passed, and all fled before his face. All save one. There waiting, silent and still in the space before the gate, sat Gandalf upon Shadowfax. Shadowfax, who alone among the free horses of the earth endured the terror, unmoving, steadfast as a graven image in Wrath-Dedan.
"You cannot enter here," said Gandalf, and the huge shadow halted. "Go back to the abyss prepared for you. Go back. Fall into the nothingness that awaits you and your master. Go!"
The black rider flung back his hood, and behold, he had a kingly crown, and yet upon no head visible was it set. The red fires shone between it and the mantle's shoulders, vast and dark. From a mouth unseen there came a deadly laughter.
"Old fool," he said, "old fool, this is my hour. Do you not know death when you see it? Die now and curse in vain."
And with that he lifted high his sword, and flames ran down the blade. Gandalf did not move. And in that very moment, away behind in some courtyard of the city, a cock crowed. Shrill and clear he crowed, recking nothing of wizardry or war, welcoming only the morning that in the sky, far above the shadows of death, was coming with the dawn. And as if in answer, there came from far away another note. Horns! 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 In dark Mindoluan sides they dimly echoed, great horns of the north wildly blowing. Rohan had come at last! Chapter 5. The Ride of the Rohirrim. It was dark, and Merry could see nothing as he lay on the ground rolled in a blanket. Yet though the night was airless and windless, all about him hidden trees were sighing softly. He lifted his head. Then he heard it again, a sound like faint drums in the wooded hills and mountain steps. The throb would cease suddenly, and then be taken up again at some other point, now nearer, now farther off. He wondered if the watchman had heard it. He couldn't see them, but he knew that all round him were the companies of the Rohirrim. He could smell the horses in the dark, and hear their shiftings and their soft stampings on the needle-covered ground. The host was bivouacked in the pine woods that clustered about Ailenach Beacon. A tall hill, standing up from the long ridges of the Druadan forest that lay beside the great road in Eastern Orion. Tired as he was, Merry couldn't sleep. He'd ridden now for 4 days on end, and the ever-deepening gloom had slowly weighed down his heart. He began to wonder why he had been so eager to come, when he had been given every excuse, even his lord's command, to stay behind. He wondered, too, if the old king knew that he'd been disobeyed and was angry. Perhaps not. There seemed to be some understanding between Durnhelm and Elfhelm, the marshal who commanded the Eorid in which they were riding. He and all his men ignored Merry and pretended not to hear if he spoke. He might have been just another bag that Durnhelm was carrying. Durnhelm was no comfort. He never spoke to anyone. Merry felt small, unwanted, and lonely. Now the time was anxious, and the host was in peril. They were less than a day's ride from the outwalls of Minas Tirith that encircled the townlands. Scouts had been sent ahead. Some had not returned. Others, hastening back, had reported that the road was held in force against them. A host of the enemy was encamped upon it, 3 miles west of Armondine, and some strength of men was already thrusting along the road and was no more than 3 leagues away. Orcs were roving in the hills and woods along the roadside. The king and Éomer held council in the watches of the night. Merry wanted somebody to talk to, and he thought of Pippin, but that only increased his restlessness. Poor Pippin, shut up in the great city of stone, lonely and afraid. Merry wished he was a tall rider like Éomer, and could blow a horn or something and go galloping to his rescue. He sat up, listening to the drums that were beating again, now nearer at hand. Presently he heard voices speaking low, and he saw dim, half-shrouded lanterns passing through the trees. Men nearby began to move uncertainly in the dark. A tall figure loomed up and stumbled over him, cursing the tree roots. He recognized the voice of the marshal, Elfhelm.
"I'm not a tree root, sir," he said, "nor a bag, but a bruised hobbit. The least you can do in amends is to tell me what is afoot."
"Anything that can keep so in this devil's murk," answered Elfhelm. "But my lord sends word that we must set ourselves in readiness. Orders may come for a sudden move."
"Is the enemy coming, then?" asked Merry anxiously. "Are those their drums?" I began to think I was imagining them, as no one else seemed to take any notice of them."
"Nay, nay," said Elfhelm. "The enemy is on the road, not in the hills. You hear the woses, the wild men of the woods. Thus they talk together from afar. They still haunt Druard and forest, it is said. Remnants of an older time they be, living few and secretly, wild and wary as the beasts. They go not to war with Gondor or the Mark, but now they're troubled by the darkness and the coming of the orcs. They fear lest the dark years be returning, as seems likely enough. Let us be thankful that they're not hunting us, for they use poisoned arrows, it's said, and they are woodcrafty beyond compare. But they have offered their services to Théoden. Even now one of their headmen is being taken to the king. Yonder go the lights. So much I've heard, but no more. And now I must busy myself with my lord's commands. Pack yourself up, Master Bag." He vanished into the shadows. Merry didn't like this talk of wild men and poisoned darts, but quite apart from that, a great weight of dread was on him. Waiting was unbearable. He longed to know what was going to happen. He got up, and soon was walking warily in pursuit of the last lantern before it disappeared among the trees. Presently he came to an open space where a small tent had been set up for the king under a great tree. A large lantern, covered above, was hanging from a bough and cast a pale circle of light below. There sat Théoden and Éomer, and before them on the ground sat a strange squat shape of a man, gnarled as an old stone, and the hairs of his scanty beard straggled on his lumpy chin like dry moss. He was short-legged and fat-armed, thick and stumpy, and clad only with grass about his waist. Merry felt that he'd seen him before somewhere, and suddenly remembered the Pookal men of Dunharrow. Here was one of those old images brought to life, or maybe a creature descended in true line through endless years from the models used by the forgotten craftsmen long ago.
There was a silence as Merry crept nearer, and then the wild man began to speak, in answer to some questions, it seemed. His voice was deep and guttural, yet to Merry's surprise he spoke the common speech, though in halting fashion, and uncouth words were mingled with it.
"No father of horsemen," he said. "We fight not. Hunt only. Kill Gorgon in woods. Hate orc folk."
"You hate Gorgon too. We help as we can. Wild men have long ears and long eyes, know all parts. Wild men live here before stone houses, before tall men come up out of water."
"But our need is for aid in battle," said Aylmer. "How will you and your folk help us?"
"Bring news," said the wild man. "We look out from hills. We climb big mountain and look down. Stone city is shut. Fire burns there outside, now inside too. You wish to come there? Then you must be quick. But Gorgon and men out of far away."
He waved a short, gnarled arm eastward.
"Sit on horse road. Very many, more than horsemen."
"How do you know that?" said Aylmer. The old man's flat face and dark eyes showed nothing, but his voice was sullen with displeasure.
"Wild men are wild, free, but not children," he answered. "I am great headman, Han Borihan. I count many things, stars in sky, leaves on trees, men in the dark. You have a score of scores counted 10 times and 5. They have more. Big fight, and who will win? And many more walk round walls of stone houses."
"Alas, he speaks all too shrewdly," said Theoden. "And our scouts say that they've cast trenches and stakes across the road. We cannot sweep them away in sudden onset."
"And yet we need great haste," said Aylmer. "Munburg is on fire."
"Let Han Borihan finish," said the wild man. "More than one road he knows. He will lead you by road where no pits are, no Gorgon walk, only wild men and beasts. Many paths were made where stonehouse folk were stronger. They carved hills as hunters carve beast flesh. Wild men think they ate stone for food. They went through Druaden to Rimmon with great wains. They go no longer. Road is forgotten, but not by wild men. Over hill and behind hill it lies still under grass and tree. There behind Rimmon and down to Dean, and back at the end to Horsemen's Road. Wild men will show you that road. Then ye will kill Gorgon and drive away bad dark with bright iron, and wild men can go back to sleep in the wild woods."
Aylmer and the king spoke together in their own tongue. At length Theoden turned to the wild man.
"We will receive your offer," he said, "for though we leave a host of foes behind, what matter? If the stone city falls, then we shall have no returning. If it is saved, then the orc host itself will be cut off. If you are faithful, Han Borihan, then we will give you rich reward, and you shall have the friendship of the Mark forever."
"Dead men are not friends to living men, and give them no gifts," said the wild man. "But if you live after the darkness, then leave wild men alone in the woods and do not hunt them like beasts any more. Han Borihan will not lead you into trap. He will go himself with father of horsemen, and if he leads you wrong, you will kill him."
"So be it," said Theoden.
"How long will it take to pass by the enemy and come back to the road?" asked Aylmer. "We must go at foot pace if you guide us, and I doubt not the way is narrow."
"Wild men go quick on feet," said Han. "Way is wide for 4 horses in stone-waned valley yonder." He waved his hand southwards. "But narrow at beginning and at end. Wild Man could walk from here to Dean between sunrise and noon.
Then we must allow at least 7 hours for the leaders, said Aylmer. But we must reckon rather on some 10 hours for all. Things unforeseen may hinder us, and if our host is all strung out, it will be long ere it can be set in order when we issue from the hills. What is the hour now?
Who knows? Said Theoden. All is night now.
It is all dark, but it is not all night, said Khan. When sun comes we feel her, even when she is hidden. Already she climbs over east mountains. It is the opening of day in the sky fields.
Then we must set out as soon as may be, said Aylmer. Even so, we cannot hope to come to Gondor's aid today. Merry waited to hear no more, but slipped away to get ready for the summons to the march. This was the last stage before the battle. It didn't seem likely to him that many of them would survive it. But he thought of Pippin and the flames in Minas Tirith, and thrust down his own dread. All went well that day, and no sight or sound had they of the enemy waiting to waylay them. The wild men had put out a screen of wary hunters, so that no orc or roving spy should learn of the movements in the hills. The light was more dim than ever as they drew nearer to the beleaguered city, and the riders passed in long files, like dark shadows of men and horses. Each company was guided by a wild woodman, but old Khan walked beside the king. The start had been slower than was hoped, for it had taken time for the riders, walking and leading their horses, to find paths over the thickly wooded ridges behind their camp, and down into the hidden stone-waned valley. It was late in the afternoon when the leaders came to wide grey thickets stretching beyond the eastward side of Armondine, and masking a great gap in the line of hills that from Nardol to Dean ran east and west. Through the gap, the forgotten Wayne Road long ago had run down, back into the main horseway from the city through Anorion. But now, for many lives of men, trees had had their way with it, and it had vanished, broken and buried under the leaves of uncounted years. But the thickets offered to the riders their last hope of cover before they went into open battle, for beyond them lay the road and the plains of Anduin, while east and southwards the slopes were bare and rocky, as the writhen hills gathered themselves together and climbed up, bastion upon bastion, into the great mass and shoulders of Myndolwyn. The leading company was halted, and as those behind filed up out of the trough of the stone-walled valley, they spread out and passed to camping places under the grey trees. The king summoned the captains to council. Aylmer sent out scouts to spy upon the road. But old Khan shook his head.
No good to send horsemen, he said. Wild men have already seen all that can be seen in the bad air. They will come soon and speak to me here.
The captains came, and then out of the trees crept warily other pukul shapes, so like old Khan that Merry could hardly tell them apart. They spoke to Khan in a strange, throaty language. Presently Khan turned to the king.
"Wild men say many things," he said. "First, be wary. Still many men in camp beyond Dean, an hour's walk yonder." He waved his arm west towards the black beacon. "But none to see between here and Stone Folk's new walls. Many busy there. Walls stand up no longer. Gorgon, knock them down with earth thunder and with clubs of black iron. They are unwary and do not look about them. They think their friends watch all roads." At that old Khan made a curious gurgling noise, and it seemed that he was laughing.
"Good tidings," cried Aylmer. "Even in this gloom hope gleams again. Our enemy's devices oft serve us in his despite. The accursed darkness itself has been a cloak to us, and now
Lusting to destroy Gondor and throw it down stone from stone, his orcs have taken away my greatest fear. The outwall could have been held long against us. Now we can sweep through, if once we win so far.
"Once again I thank you, Han Burihan of the Woods," said Theoden. "Good fortune go with you for tidings and for guidance."
"Kill Gorgon, kill orc folk. No other words please, wild men," answered Han. "Drive away bad air and darkness with bright iron."
"To do these things we have ridden far," said the king, "and we shall attempt them. But what we shall achieve only tomorrow will show."
Han Burihan squatted down and touched the earth with his horny brow in token of farewell. Then he got up as if to depart. But suddenly he stood looking up like some startled woodland animal snuffling a great air. A light came in his eyes.
"Wind is changing," he cried,
and with that, in a twinkling, as it seemed, he and his fellows had vanished into the glooms, never to be seen by any rider of Rohan again. Not long after, far away eastward, the faint drums throbbed again. Yet to no heart in all the host came any fear that the wild men were unfaithful, strange and unlovely though they might appear.
"We need no further guidance," said Elfhelm, "for there are riders in the host who have ridden down to Munnburg in days of peace. I, for one. When we come to the road it will veer south, and there will lie before us still 7 leagues ere we reach the wall of the townlands. Along most of that way there's much grass on either side of the road. On that stretch the errant riders of Gondor reckon to make their greatest speed. We may ride it swiftly and without great rumour.
Then, since we must look for fell deeds and the need of all our strength," said Éomer, "I counsel that we rest now, and set out hence by night, and so time our going that we come upon the fields when tomorrow is as light as it will be, or when our Lord gives the signal." To this the king assented, and the captains departed. But soon Elfhelm returned.
"The scouts have found naught to report beyond the Grey Wood, Lord," he said, "save 2 men only, 2 dead men and 2 dead horses.
"Well," said Éomer, "what of it?"
"This, Lord. They were errand riders of Gondor. Hirgon was one, maybe. At least his hand still clasped the red arrow, but his head was hewn off. And this also. It would seem, by the signs, that they were fleeing westward when they fell. As I read it, they found the enemy already on the outwall, or assailing it, when they returned. And that would be 2 nights ago, if they used fresh horses from the posts, as is their wont. They couldn't reach the city and turned back."
"Alas," said Theoden.
"Then Denethor has heard no news of our riding, and will despair of our coming."
"Need brooks no delay, yet late is better than never," said Éomer, "and mayhap in this time shall the old saw be proved truer than ever before, since men spoke with mouth." It was night. On either side of the road the host of Rohan was moving silently. Now the road, passing about the skirts of Mindolwin, turned southward. Far away and almost straight ahead there was a red glow under the black sky, and the sides of the great mountain loomed dark against it.
They were drawing near the Ramas of the Pelennor, but the day was not yet come. The king rode in the midst of the leading company, his household men about him. Elfhelm's Eorid came next, and now Merry noticed that Durnhelm had left his place and in the darkness was moving steadily forward, until at last he was riding just in rear of the king's guard. There came a check. Merry heard voices in front speaking softly. Outriders had come back who had ventured forward almost to the wall. They came to the king.
"There are great fires, Lord," said one. "The city is all set about with flame, and the field is all full of foes, but all seem drawn off to the assault, as well as we could guess. There are few left upon the outwall, and they are heedless, busy in destruction.
"Do you remember the wild man's words, Lord?" said another. "I live upon the open wold in days of peace. Weedfarer is my name, and to me also the air brings messages. Already the wind is turning. There comes a breath out of the south. There is a sea tang in it, faint though it be. The morning will bring new things. About the reek it will be dawn when you pass the wall."
"If you speak truly, Weedfarer, then may you live beyond this day in years of blessedness," said Théoden. He turned to the men of his household who were near, and he spoke now in a clear voice, so that many also of the riders of the first Eorid had heard them.
"Now is the hour come, riders of the Mark, sons of Eorl. Foes and fire are before you, and your homes far behind. Yet, though you fight upon an alien field, the glory that you reap there shall be your own forever. Oaths ye have taken, now fulfil them all, to lord and land and league of friendship."
Men clashed spear upon shield.
"Eomer, my son, you lead the first Eorid," said Théoden, "and it shall go behind the king's banner in the centre. Elfhelm, lead your company to the right when we pass the wall, and Grimbold shall lead his towards the left. Let the other companies behind follow these three that lead, as they have chance. Strike wherever the enemy gathers. Other plans we cannot make, for we know not yet how things stand upon the field. Forth now, and fear no darkness."
The leading company rode off as swiftly as they could, for it was still deep dark, whatever change Weedfarer might forebode. Merry was riding behind Durnhelm, clutching with the left hand, while with the other he tried to loosen his sword in its sheath. He felt now bitterly the truth of the old king's words, "In such a battle, what would you do, Meriadoc?" "Just this," he thought. "Encumber a rider, and hope at best to stay in my seat and not be pounded to death by galloping hooves." It was no more than a league to where the outwalls had stood. They soon reached them, too soon for Merry. Wild cries broke out, and there was some clash of arms, but it was brief. The orcs busy about the walls were few and amazed, and they were quickly slain or driven off. Before the ruin of the north gate in the Ramas, the king halted again. The first Eorid drew up behind him and about him on either side. Durnhelm kept close to the king, though Elfhelm's company was away on the right. Grimbold's men turned aside and passed round to a great gap in the wall further eastward. Merry peered from behind Durnhelm's back. Far away, maybe 10 miles or more, there was a great burning, but between it and the riders lines of fire blazed in a vast crescent, at the nearest point less than a league distant. He could make out little more on the dark plain, and as yet he neither saw any hope of morning, nor felt any wind, changed or unchanged. Now silently the host of Rohan moved forward into the field of Gondor, pouring in slowly but steadily, like the rising tide through breaches in a dike that men have thought secure. But the mind and will of the black captain was bent wholly on the falling city, and as yet no tidings came to him warning that his designs held any flaw. After a while the king led his men away, somewhat eastward, to come between the fires of the siege and the outer fields. Still they were unchallenged, and still Théoden gave no signal. At last he halted once again. The city was now nearer. A smell of burning was in the air, and a very shadow of death. The horses were uneasy. But the king sat upon Snowmane, motionless, gazing upon the agony of Minas Tirith, as if stricken suddenly by anguish or by dread. He seemed to shrink down, cowed by age. Merry himself felt as if a great weight of horror and doubt had settled on him. His heart beat slowly. Time seemed poised in uncertainty. They were too late. Too late was worse than never. Perhaps Theoden would quail, bow his old head, turn, slink away to hide in the hills. Then suddenly Merry felt it at last, beyond a doubt, a change. Wind was in his face, light was glimmering. Far, far away in the south, the clouds could be dimly seen as remote grey shapes, rolling up, drifting. Morning lay beyond them. But at that same moment there was a flash, as if lightning had sprung from the earth beneath the city. For a searing second it stood dazzling far off in black and white, its topmost tower like a glittering needle, and then, as the darkness closed again, there came rolling over the fields a great boom. At that sound the bent shape of the king sprang suddenly erect. Tall and proud he seemed again, and rising in his stirrups, he cried in a loud voice, more clear than any there had ever heard a mortal man achieve before, "Arise! Arise! Riders of Theoden! Fell deeds awake! Fire and slaughter!